Thank you so much for joining us for Spirit, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires the way. I'm Judy Steinig, Senior Director of the OU's Department of Community Projects and Partnerships and coordinator and host for Spirit. The OU started Spirit several years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it as an online program for retirees, not yet retirees, baby boomers, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents, and seniors, everyone who is looking for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Spirit continues to be the safe and ideal way for everyone to connect and learn together in a virtual setting. Today's program will bring many of us back to our younger days as we examine Soviet Jewry, lessons learned through a retrospective lens. It will be presented by Jacques Laurie, Executive and Educational Director of Congregation Shari Shemayim in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Doc has traveled numerous times to the Soviet Union, including an encounter with the KGB. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that. His ongoing passion has been to educate later generations about the struggle of Soviet Jews as it relates to today's Jewish community and the lessons learned concerning advocacy. His complete bio is in the emails that you've been receiving and on the Spirit website. It is my honor and pleasure to turn the Spirit Forum over to Jacques Laurie. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you so much. Let me take just 1 second of personal privilege. I see that my daughter, Rebecca, is on with us today. Rebecca works for the OU, and Rebecca has grown up in the Soviet Jewry movement, as I would say, from spending her days in the stroller at rally after rally and at the dinner table. So as I get older, I surely forget things, and Rebecca, surely you have my blessing to jump in and tell me when I've made a mistake or what I've forgotten. At any rate, so let's go back in time, and as retirees and myself, we can go back to the time when we were younger, and we remember the beginnings of the Soviet Jewry movement, and we remember the community beginning to say, "Let my people go." I remember clearly in my early days in religious school being handed postcards and being told to write on that postcard, "Dear Chairman Brezhnev, let my people go." And they would collect those postcards and they would send them out, and always wondering, gee, what difference did that really make? As time went on and I got into my college days, I joined a group, and it must have stuck with me. And I said, when I sat at the table with the leadership of the group, I said, gee, do you have an adopted Soviet Jewish family? And they said, no, but now we do, because you're going to do it. You're going to spearhead. So we took the bull by the horns, and we went to the local JCRC and said, give us a family that we can write to, that we can do something for. And they came back and gave us a name from Moscow. And I said, you know what? I'd rather not have somebody from Moscow or Leningrad or the big cities. Give us somebody somewhere that nobody is knowing about, that people aren't traveling there, that would really make a difference. If they were to get a letter from us, they would feel as though that's important. So we got the name of a family in outside of Chisinau, a town called Bendari in Moldova. It turns out later on, Moldova is going to become much more prevalent in the Soviet Jewry movement. As it turns out, Ida Nudel, a world famous refusnik, was banished to Bendari after hanging a sign outside her apartment, "Let me go to Israel." At any rate, we really, in great fervor, adopted this family. We would write letters, and we said, you know what, how about if we try and make a telephone call to this family? But we were to find out, and over time, how difficult it was just to make a telephone call. You know, when you wanted to call Israel, you picked up the phone and you dialed the phone. It wasn't a big deal, but not so with the Soviet Union. back in those days, we had Ma Bell and we had AT&T, and you had to dial 00 to get to AT&T, and you had to make a telephone call by telling the AT&T operator, I want to call the Soviet Union. Oh, wait a minute, I forgot to mention to you, the person that I'm calling has had their phone taken away. Their phone was taken away because they were Jewish, because they were activists, and they took their phone away. They didn't want them having contact with the West. So how were we to make this telephone call? Well, as it turns out, over time, this AT&T operator I became friendly with, and she let me stay on the phone while she would make the phone call to Moscow, and she would try and get the Moscow operator to answer the phone. Finally, maybe that day, the Moscow operator was going to answer the phone. Sometimes it took a week before they would answer the phone. So she would answer the phone and our operator would say, we're calling Vyacheslav Royak in Bandari, Moldova, and here's the address. Why do they need the address? Because remember, he lost his phone, which meant they would send him a message to come to the local post office. And he would have to go to the local post office on the day and time that I was saying I was going to call. Think about that for a minute. You're not a favorite of the KGB. Now you're not only taking a call you're not supposed to do, but you're going to go to the local post office to get it. So let's go back. The operator says, okay, I have all the information. I'm sorry, no such person exists. Wait a minute. You're in Moscow. How do you know no such person exists? The AT&T operators were incredibly patient. Deary, please, I need this call. It's important. And maybe that day they would put that call through. So come Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock when the call is supposed to go through, we're hoping that Royak actually got the message to come, that he's there, he's waiting, and that they're going to let that call go through. The call finally goes through, and the great awaited conversation now occurs. And we say, Vyacheslav, how's the weather today? And he says, oh, it's been very, very difficult weather this week. He's decided not to speak openly this day, and he's going to let us know things are difficult. And we continue to have these conversations. Sometimes he would be quite open and tell us exactly what was going on, and someone went off to prison that week or whatever might be going on. Time goes on, and in 1982, I make the decision we're going to travel to the Soviet Union. The local JCRC was going to help, and I was paired up with another individual, and we're going to travel to the Soviet Union. We're getting all of our things ready. It's not like traveling anywhere else. We're getting Hebrew books, and we're putting them together and figuring out how much we can jam into our suitcase. We're buying jeans, because after all, you can use jeans to give away to the Jewish kindergarten. Why does the Jewish kindergarten need a pair of jeans? Because at that time, a pair of jeans sold for a month's salary, which meant that, what is a Jewish kindergarten? A Jewish kindergarten is where somebody decides they're going to leave their flat. They're going to go live with someone else. And their flat is now going to become, their apartment's going to become a Jewish kindergarten. How are they going to support it? They're going to do everything they can to piecemeal together money to support this Jewish kindergarten. And we would bring things like jeans that would sell for a month's salary to help to support that kindergarten. So we're putting together all these different things. We're writing down the names of refuseniks in books, in codes, so that if the book got taken away, they wouldn't know that it was a refusenik's name. At any rate, just before we're going to leave, a couple weeks before we're going to leave, the Soviets shoot down Korean Airline 007. It was a passenger airline that strayed into Soviet airspace and got shot down. 260 some people are killed. The United States says no more flights from Moscow into the United States. What are we to do? We go to the travel agent. Travel agent says, look, I can get you in through Helsinki. I can't promise you I can get you out. With a chuckle, she said, but you can always take a train out. So we decide we're going to go. So we get on the plane. We're ready to go. By the way, I forgot to tell you that Vyacheslav Royak, the person who I've been talking to for these number of years, who I'm so excited we're going to get a chance to see in person, happens to be a diabetic. And the Soviets, the KGB, has come to him on numerous occasions and threatened to withhold his insulin. If he didn't stop his Jewish activities, he would lose his insulin. So I was bringing a year's worth of insulin, including a year's worth of syringes with me. We get on the plane, we transfer in Helsinki, and we're on the Aeroflot plane, the Russian airline, and a young, older Jewish man sits down next to me, and I take out the insulin and ask the stewardess to refrigerate it for me, and he looks at me and says, "You have enough insulin there for years. What are you doing?" And I want to crawl under the seat and say, "Please be quiet. I don't need this." Not to mention the year's worth of syringes that are in the suitcase. At any rate, I get to passport control, and with passport control, there's a bright light over your head. There's a young fellow in an army uniform with a visor that comes down over his eyes, and he looks at my picture, and he looks at me, and he looks at the picture, and he looks at me, and finally he waves me off. So I go now to customs, we put our bags up, and a young, fellow in uniform is emptying out my luggage, and he's making piles. He's making piles of clothes. He didn't care about the insulin, but he made a separate pile of Jewish books. And I kept saying, why are you putting my books over here? And he wouldn't answer me. And I finally said, "I'm a teacher. I need my books," as he picked up my books to walk away with him. I said, "I'm a teacher. I need my books." He stopped and in perfect English looked at me and said, "What Russians are you going to be teaching Hebrew to?" They take the books away. We don't really fight over the fact that they take these books away because, after all, they may end up on the black market, and that's okay. And there are other things in our luggage we don't want to jeopardize, so they take the books away. I meet my friend, and I ask him how his experience was. He says, "The Dr. Seuss book." He said, "The Dr. Seuss book in Hebrew, they took it away." And I said, "Did they say anything to you why?" And he said, "Yes. They told me it had ancient religious significance." On one hand, you had to laugh at that and say, "Dr. Seuss, ancient religious significance." On the other hand, you had to look beyond that and you had to say, gee, if you want to stop the education of Jews, what place do you start? You start at the very youngest age, and this is where we're going to do it. And that's why we take away a Dr. Seuss book. So we get into Moscow and we transfer and we fly to Kishinev. And this is really, going to be our first stop. And I'm so excited. I'm going to get at some point a chance to meet Vyacheslav Royak and Bendari. But first, we're going to see the Moonblitz. The Moonblitz live in a very wonderful place for us. In the Soviet Union, you weren't able to stay in any hotel you wanted to. You could only stay in the hotels run by the government, the in-tourist hotels. And they told you where you stayed, and there was only one in-tourist hotel in Kishinev. Well, it turns out Moonblitz hotel apartment building was right next to the hotel. So it was easy. We could come out of the hotel and go to see Moonblitz. And we did that, and we walked over to the apartment building, and there were a bunch of people standing by the front door. We said, "You know what? Not a good idea." We kept walking. We came back an hour later. No one there. We went in, we go up, we knock on the door, and nobody's answering. I'm heartbroken, and all of a sudden, the door opens a peep, and I identify myself, and Aaron's wife puts her finger to her lips and says, "Shh," ushers us in. We sit down on the couch. I pull out my Mickey Mouse slate. You remember, your grandchildren may have one, the children had them. You write on it and you lift up and it disappears, the Mickey Mouse slate. The long-awaited conversation is going to happen on the Mickey Mouse slate. 10 minutes, 15 minutes into the conversation, there's a knock at the door. I see what happens. Aaron's wife goes to the door. She opens the door a little bit and somebody pushes in the door, and it's two KGB agents. And they proceed to have a long 15-minute conversation with Aaron, and Aaron is laughing. And he finally, he translates for me, and he says, "Jacques," he said, "they asked me who you were, and I said I didn't know." And he said, "I finally admitted that I was just being a good Russian host. I saw you in the hallway, and I invited you in for tea." He said, "I'm about to tell them that I actually do, I might know who you are." He said, "They're going to ask you for your passport. He said, don't worry about it. They're going to write everything down and they're going to send you away. So this is exactly what happened. And we go back to the hotel after being sent back. We get to the floor of the hotel where our room is. And in the Soviet Union, I affectionately call it a tea lady. There's a woman that sits there at the desk right outside the elevator, and she gives you your key and she takes your key. It's very convenient because they can also, without using their key, they can get into your room, which we know that they do. And we don't leave anything in the room. We carry everything with us that's of any importance because we know they'll go through your luggage. At any rate, we get our key, we go into the room. We don't get 2 feet into the room and the phone rings and it's the translator for the manager of the hotel. And manager of the hotel would like to see us. So we come down to the manager's office. And he says, so what do you think of Kishinev? We saw Pushkin Park. What an amazing, amazing place, Pushkin Park. He said, really? He said, what do you think of the flats, the apartments here in Kishinev? And we said, you know, by American standards, they're okay. He says, do you know you're not allowed to visit Soviet citizens without special permission? We said, really? And I pulled out a book. And the book said, Moscow, visit our people. I said, look, it says right here, visit your people. And he said, no, you need special permission. And then he looked at me and he could see that we were being defensive and pushing on him. And he said, you know, he said, it's dangerous to walk the streets of Kishinev. I don't know where it came from. And I looked at him and I said, that's very interesting because in America, the communists all say that there's no crime in the Soviet Union. And with that, he looks directly at me and he says, you could fall and get hurt and no one would know. We knew we pushed far enough. We knew there weren't very many Americans in Kishinev. We knew this was a tough time. We knew that they just shot down the Korean airline. We accomplished what we wanted to accomplish. They know we were there. Unfortunately, we didn't get to see the refuseniks we wanted to see, and surely I was devastated we didn't get to see Vyacheslav, but perhaps we'd be able to get him his insulin on our next stop. Maybe someone would take it to him. So we walked around the streets of Kishinev, and we took these guys on a tour for the rest of the day. As we walked, these two big goons, as we walked out the door, these two big goons followed us, and we took them on a tour of Kishinev. We then went to what was then called Leningrad. And we were at Leningrad on a very, very special day. Leningrad, it was Simchas Torah. And in the Soviet Union, it was the one time people weren't afraid to come out and be Jewish and be in a crowd because they felt the protection of the crowd. We got to the synagogue. We were there a little bit late. It was jam-packed outside the synagogue. You couldn't move. And we're looking for a fellow named Yosef Radomazilsky. How the devil, we're supposed to meet him here, how the devil are we ever going to find him? We try to get into the synagogue, you can't even get into the synagogue, it's so crowded. And lo and behold, standing on the steps, we see a guy holding up a sign, and it says, my name is Yosef Radomazilsky, I teach Hebrew. We obviously found Yosef. Sadly, what we were also to find out is the next day, Yosef was beat up. No surprise. He was standing out there with the sign saying, my name is Yosef Radomazilsky, and I teach Hebrew. This was life in the former Soviet Union. Time goes on, and we go back to the Soviet Union. And just prior to going back in 1986, Gorbachev comes to power, and Gorbachev talks about glasnost, and he talks about openness. And the Soviet Jews are very excited about it because perhaps there'll be an opening. Perhaps there'll be a chance for them to be Jews. Perhaps they'll have a chance to leave the Soviet Union and reunite with their families in Israel. And I should take a break for 1 second here and say to you, here is one of the moral dilemmas that we faced in the Soviet Jewry movement. In order to leave the Soviet Union, Soviet Jews said that they were reuniting with family in Israel, and that gave them the right to leave the Soviet Union to go to Israel. And that made them different from anybody else, This was a reunification. It wasn't a political movement. It was a reunification movement. And what we found is then we had what was called Nishira, dropout. And there were Soviet Jews who were coming to America. And by the way, the Israelis, in many cases, were very unhappy with Americans traveling to the Soviet Union, because unfortunately, at times, Americans were going to the Soviet Union, visiting refuseniks and talking about their two-car garages. And Soviet Jews thought that the streets were paved in gold in the United States, and maybe I should go to the United States, I shouldn't go to Israel. And on the reverse side, the argument was the Soviets might shut down immigration because they'll say this is a scam. They're not really going to Israel. They want to come to the United States. And you had the Jewish community in the United States broke into parts, where you had two different national organizations. One said, we'll help anybody wherever they want to go. And you had another, the National Conference on Soviet Jewry, that said, no, we are determined to really say that you have to go to Israel. And now for the most incredible dilemma to think about for a moment. There was a moment when there was a discussion about saying, what if we allowed Soviet Jews to go to Israel and they could spend a year or two in Israel? And if they decided they didn't like it in Israel, they'd be able to come to the United States. Okay, maybe that's not so bad, maybe. Except there was a dilemma. And the dilemma was that when Soviet Jews came to the United States, they got benefits. They were considered refugees. It was a political designation that allowed them to get financial benefit. If they went to Israel and then came to the United States, they would not be refugees. They would not get benefits. You're only a refugee from a country where you are persecuted, or the United States makes that decision that for some reason you should get these benefits. So then somebody stands up and says, well, I have an idea. Let's go put pressure on the United States government to say, if they come to Israel and they stay a year there and then they come here, they can maintain their benefits. They can be refugees. Think about that for just one moment. Think about a Jew being a refugee from Israel. What a horrible, horrible thought that we would ever consider a Jew leaving Israel to being a refugee. So this was the kinds of dilemmas that were going on in the Soviet Jewry movement all during this time. Yet on the other hand, let's keep in mind in 86, 87, as we put 250,000 people on the Mall in Washington, largest Jewish gathering on behalf of anybody or anything, the world Jewish community was coming together. We were going to save a people. We were, put it in perspective, we came off the days of the Holocaust. And that's what drove me into the Soviet Jewry movement, was my own thoughts of where were my parents, where were my grandparents, what were they doing during the Holocaust? Did they stand up? Did we do enough? And we were actually beginning to succeed. 1987, we have the creation of the all-Jewish, the VOD in the Soviet Union. It's basically a Jewish Congress. We're having Jewish organizations pop up, and we go back to the Soviet Union. And we go back this time, I go back as the international chair for B'nai B'rith, and we go to the all-Jewish Congress and see people from all these crazy places throughout the Soviet Union, Jews in every corner of the Soviet Union, talking about a revival of Jewish life and trying to take advantage of the slightest openings that were going on. In fact, we later on, we're going to, from somebody we met, we're going to create a camp in the 90s in a place called Birabidzhan. Birabidzhan, what the heck is Birabidzhan? It's out by Russia. It was created by Stalin. It was meant to be a place that Stalin wanted all the Jews to come to. The official language of Birabidzhan was Yiddish. In fact, above the train station in Birabidzhan, it said Birabidzhan in Yiddish. All of these places that you'd never think of, there were Jews there, and they were gathering at this all-Jewish Congress. Sadly, I took a trip as well. We went to Riga, and in Riga, a refusenik took us through the streets of Riga and took us to the site where the Jews of Riga were slaughtered. And one of the most moving moments in my lifetime, was to be shown a mass grave. It was kind of like a hump there with a playground on top. And to just think that this was the Soviet response to the Holocaust, was a mass grave with children playing on a playground. So time goes on and we come back in 1991, things are opening up a little bit more. I go back with Seymour Reich, who is the president of the President's Conference. President's Conference, those don't know, all the major Jewish organizations, their presidents make up a group. It's called the President's Conference. Seymour happens to also be the president of B'nai B'rith International. And Seymour, we go to the Soviet Union, and Seymour would like to meet with Gorbachev. In the end, at the very last second, we're not given the meeting with Gorbachev, but we meet with the Minister of Culture and we meet with the Minister of Education, and we're talking about the plight of Soviet Jews, and we're talking about more openness. We're talking about, you know, glasnost, openness. Gorbachev's theme is openness, and we want Soviet Jews to be able to take advantage of it. And by the way, we have a B'nai B'rith group in Moscow that wants to charter, and we want you to know that we want them to be permitted to charter and start the first B'nai B'rith group in Moscow. And the Minister of Education, the Minister of Culture, they all nod their head. Very interesting, but not now, not now, not now. So we go back that night and we tell the group that they're not now, not now, not now. And they look at us, now, now, now. And they say, we're going to a restaurant tonight. We want you there. And the B'nai B'rith group is going to converge on a restaurant in Moscow. And we want you to give us the first charter of the B'nai B'rith group in Moscow. And in fact, that happens. And even with openness, there's a lot of fear and a lot of concern. Clearly, the government was opposed to it. But this group decided they were going to move forward and they were going to do it. Things open more and a little bit more, and we run a Jewish camp in Birobidzhan, and we run a camp in Lithuania. And amazingly, we have a B'nai B'rith group that publishes the Black Book in Lithuania. Mind-boggling to think about. The Black Book, a definitive story about anti-Jewish crimes in the Soviet Union during the Holocaust. Was never permitted to be published in Russia, and it was being published in Lithuania by this small printer who was going to print the book, followed by printing the Diary of Anne Frank. I actually see online with us a woman who I sent to Lithuania, and she went with the American Holocaust Museum, as well as Yad Vashem, and ran a seminar, actually went back twice, ran a seminar to teach the Holocaust to teachers in Lithuania. It was very controversial at the time. There were folks who said, you shouldn't be doing this. It's a cheap idea. You shouldn't be doing this, that it's not the right thing to do. Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum, and B'nai B'rith all agreed. We had rules to it. We told the Lithuanians at the moment they stop us from saying anything we need to say, we pack up our bags and we leave. And Judy can tell you that it was an amazing moment in Lithuania to be able to offer this to the teachers. A long, long, long way to go about Holocaust education for sure, but it was at least an opening. It was the beginning. So let's move on. And all of a sudden, there's a coup in the Soviet Union. Yeltsin is holding a coup. And the president of B'nai B'rith gets a call. The president in Moscow gets a call. And I'll tell you what he says in a minute. We on the United States side are seeing this coup going on. What's going to happen to the Jewish community? What is the effect? What, are our people going to be safe? I go back to my contacts in Pittsburgh, the AT&T long lines operator, and I say, if ever I need you, this is the time. And she says, Jacques, we're going to do it for you. We're going to get your call through. And she gets a call through to Sasha Schmuckler. Sasha happens to have a phone. Things have lightened up a little bit. And Sasha answers the phone. Sasha is 26 years old. just had a baby, and he says to me, Jacques, I got a call from the Yeltsin people, and they want us to support the coup. Jacques, I forgot to tell you, just before the coup, I received permission for my family to leave. What should I do? Sasha, how do I answer that question? I can't tell you what to do. Sasha is putting his life at risk by supporting the coup. Perhaps Sasha, even if he's not putting his life at risk, he surely would lose his opportunity to leave. What can I tell him? The only thing I can tell him is, Sasha, you do what you think is right, and B'nai B'rith will stand behind you. And Sasha did ultimately issue a statement from B'nai B'rith Moscow supporting the coup. Ultimately, Sasha did exercise his permission to leave, and lives happily, last I heard, somewhere in the United States. And actually, when I say that, and I say I don't exactly know, one of the things that I've believed over time is we really need to let Soviet Jews make their mark. We needed to give them space. We needed them not to be dependent upon those of us that were trying to help them get out. They really needed to create their own lives. And while I had contact and whatnot, a lot of the contact waned over time, and I think for the best. But I'll tell you the one visit that I had when I got to Israel a number of years later after the Royaks got there. Sadly, Vyacheslav had passed away from complications of his diabetes. But we met his wife and his daughters, and we met in a hotel. And we sat and we talked. We never had a chance to meet in person before. And we talked about so many things of what was happening here and what they were seeing there and the pieces they didn't know about what were happening here. And all of a sudden, their older daughter started to cry. And I looked at her and she responded to me and she said, my parents always told me there were people in the world that cared about us, but I never understood what that meant. It really brings us to the whole question of advocacy. And the Jewish community surely faces, it's not a new issue and it's not an old issue. It's an issue that we need to advocate on behalf of ourselves. And I think the lesson we learned from the Soviet Jewry movement is we can be successful. We can do it, even though sometimes we think the task is way too big. We have to remember that when Anatoly Sharansky walked across the bridge from East Germany into West Germany, and he stopped in the middle of the bridge, and he thanked the children and the housewives for getting him out of the Soviet Union and saving his life. It was those letters that I talked about, as silly as they may have sounded, to Chairman Brezhnev, saying, let my people go. But it was because of that advocacy that we saw things like 250,000 Jews on the Mall, or we saw something called the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. It was an amendment that tied Soviet grain prices, the price that the Soviets paid for grain from the United States, to the level of emigration. And that emigration was specifically really designed towards Soviet Jews. And it was because of those pressures that we saved millions of Jews who came out of the Soviet Union. It was that advocacy. And I say to you today that that's the advocacy that we have to remember and we have to talk about. And we have to say, when we look at Israel and we look at world Jewry and we look at what's going on, we can make a difference. Each and every one of us has the ability to do it, even though at that moment in time, when you're writing that little postcard, it may not seem to be very much. You remember when Sharansky walked across that bridge, who he thanked first. We really and truly can make a difference. Thank you. Your questions?
Thank you so much, Jacques. That was truly amazing. You brought all of us back to our youth, with stories, the things that we could never have imagined. Amazing. And I love the way you also brought it up to the current of how it can be, its relevance now. If there's any comments or questions, you can put them into the chat and we'll be happy to address them. In the meantime, I also want to give a shout out to my colleague, Becca Zeebowitz, who told me about her father. We were having a discussion a number of weeks ago about my department, her department, all these things. And I told her all about Spirit. Becca's obviously not the age for Spirit. And the first thing she said is, "What about my father?" I said, "That sounds amazing." So I want to thank Jacques very much. And I want to thank Becca for bringing up such a wonderful topic and giving us such a wonderful speaker. I don't see anything in the chat. Jacques, do you have anything?
No, I don't. Another interesting story was I was invited to go to Germany. I served on the Philadelphia School Board in the 90s, and I was invited to come on a delegation to go visit Germany shortly after reunification. It was sponsored by the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, which was closely tied to the government. And there was an attempt to say, they're trying to bring young Jewish politicians, public officials to Germany to understand and create relationship. And one of the places on our stop was in a place called Erfurt. Erfurt was in the old East Germany, and they were taking us there to see a Soviet Jewish absorption center. Absorption center paid for by the government, and they wanted us to see what they were doing and how they were trying to support the Soviet Jews in East Germany. I had to ask the question. I knew the answer to it, but the people with me really didn't know, weren't involved in the Soviet Jewry movement, but I asked the question because I knew it would be instructive. And I said to an older woman sitting there on a chair on the porch, I said, "So tell us, of all the places in the world you could have chosen to go when you got out of the Soviet Union, why would it be that you chose to go to Germany?" And she didn't skip a beat. She looked at me and said, "Israel isn't safe. I couldn't get into America, so I came to Germany." And I think that as we look back on the Soviet emigration, on the Soviet Jewry emigration, it really points out so many of these dilemmas that we were faced with. And if I have one regret in my time in the Soviet Jewry movement, and I'm not sure I could have done it differently, but I was one of those who was so focused on getting Soviet Jews out of the Soviet Union that we really weren't paying attention to what was happening after they got out of the Soviet Union. Our assumption was the Jewish community would deal with that, the Jewish community would handle that, and absorption was really a very difficult issue. It was a difficult issue even just in my local community, because the cultural differences between, when 5,000 Jews show up on the doorstep, and the synagogues all ran out and bought prayer books, and they were going to have this great high holiday because all the Soviet Jews were going to come to the synagogue, and we had a party, and they didn't show up. I knew they wouldn't show up in one sense. I knew that we had to understand that it's going to take time and we need to work with them. And this isn't the background that they have. They haven't been able to practice Judaism. This isn't going to happen. But we had created these heroes, and they truly were heroes. But yet we didn't understand the absorption as well as we should. So if there's any regret that I have in my time, that would be the regret that I would point to.
I don't have a question, just a comment of appreciation. Somebody who says, "I marched for Soviet Jewry and always want to thank those who did more than just march. Thank you for all you've done." So I think many of us, I remember going to the marches myself. And I think that, you really just showed us how much more could be done and the success. I don't see any other comments there. I guess people are just thinking.
There was a comment about moral issue of choice. And I think the question being that it says, "My wife and I visited Refuseniks for 3 weeks in 76. Can we comment on the moral issue of choice? And I think I touched on the moral issue of choice. And by the way, this is a place where the American Jewish community was really at odds with the Israelis, because the Israelis absolutely wanted it shut down. They did not want Soviet Jews coming to the United States. And the Israelis, I bet to this day, would argue that they have a better chance at keeping Soviet Jews connected to their Jewishness than those who came to the United States. But I think that, as we all know, in Jewish thought and Jewish life and whatnot, could we bring ourselves to saying we're going to work to get you out, but we're going to tell you where you have to go, would be the argument on the other side. And it was it was one of those moments where you worried that we were going to fracture the community, the advocacy community, over this issue. We had two national organizations that really disliked each other terribly, and it was over that issue. And one could truly look at it and say, was it going to really interfere with the ability to get Soviet Jews out? And not to mention that understanding the Israeli view on this, and it was understandable. So yes, it was, in my days in the Soviet Jewry movement, we spent a lot of time dealing, especially in Philadelphia, where both organizations, it was the only city, I believe, in the country where both organizations coexisted.
Okay. I don't have anything else. Do you?
Did I work with Joe Smuckler, who is active in Soviet Jewry? Yes. Joe was the chair of the Soviet Jewry Council for many years in Philadelphia. In so many ways, Joe was almost one of the fathers of the whole Soviet Jewry movement. Connie, his wife, I know, was actually on a list, was not permitted back into the Soviet Union. Really, Philadelphia had incredible leadership in the Soviet Jewry movement, and Joe surely was, all the shalom, Joe was one of those leaders, for sure.
Okay.
Let's see if there was anything else here. Bring back memories. We adopted a Soviet Jewish family, had a chain of people write to them. We numbered our letters, as did the family. Few were received, but enough to let us know they were involved. The point you're making is so pertinent, because we went down and that they did not stay in touch. That was really, those letters were lifelines. They truly were lifelines. Imagine going up against a massive government that is determined to keep you down, that when you applied to leave, you lost your job, you were harassed, you were not allowed to go to university. Remember also, in the Soviet Union, you had an identity card. And your identity card, everybody had an identity card. You were either Russian or Ukrainian or Lithuanian, unless you were Jewish. You could live anywhere in the Soviet Union, and that identity card said Jew on it. So when you went to university and applied for the university, it said Jew on it, and you weren't admitted. You're going up against this system. You are all alone. You are all alone. And the only thing you have to hold on to is what that young girl said to me in Israel. My parents told me there was somebody out there who cared about us. And that those letters were just so critical. So the fact that you wrote them, you numbered them, you did those things is really, don't underestimate how important that was.
Okay. Okay, I think at this moment, I just want to remind everybody, you don't know this yet. Next week, we will not be having spirit session. It's for many, many families. It's yeshiva week when children are on vacation, grandchildren are on vacation. So we hope that everybody will have the opportunity to get together with families in a COVID safe way. So we're not going to be having a spirit program next week. You will be getting emails about future programs. So just stay tuned. I also want to comment about another program that you're going to be hearing about that might be relevant for anybody on this program, as well as for your children. And that is the OU's virtual home relocation fair. This is another one of my projects, and which will be Sunday, February 13th. It is online for the comfort of your home. If you are interested in moving somewhere, if anybody you know is interested in moving, this is the way to find out about over 60 communities throughout the United States and Israel. We have registrations coming in literally from all over the world. So you're going to see registration in your email coming out today with the recording and other future ones. So just keep it in mind. If it's relevant for you, please participate. There's no cost. And if it's something for somebody you know, forward it to them. Okay, everybody, have a great day. Have a great week. I'll wish you a good Shabbos in advance. And we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. Take care. Thank you so much, Jacques. We really Absolutely. Appreciate it. And Becca, thank you for making the shidduch. Take care, everybody.
Okay. Take care.